Park against the Indiana University School of Dentistry is our next case. You seem to be attracted to dentists. What's going on? Mr. Ackerson.
May it please the Court. I'm Nels Ackerson, representing the plaintiff appellant, Ms. Park. This appeal is from a dismissal and simultaneous entry of judgment 3 months after a case was filed and subsequent denial of leave to amend. With your leave, I would like to address in my few minutes three sets of issues that we believe are central to this case. Those three are the standard of review under Rule 12b-6, after Twombly and Iqbal, this Court's precedence for leave to amend, and the tension that often exists between judicial enforcement of students' rights and deference to academic decisions. First, on the standard of review.
But before we get to that, I have a broader question, which is, really, aren't you arguing just that she had a right to even more process than she got? And, you know, you don't have a right to process all by itself, not for its own sake, much as we lawyers love process. It's got to relate to some underlying right. And I'm not sure under Indiana law or anything else I see such a right in this complaint.
Well, the right begins with the contract right, which is specifically stated here. Unlike many of the other cases that have been before this Court on similar academic issues, there is a contract, there's a student code of contract.
Why is that pertinent? We have held that a claim for breach of contract cannot be litigated under the Due Process Clause, even if the opposing party in the contract is a state or municipal government. That it has to be litigated as a contract in state court. Or, to put it differently, all the process due for a claim of breach of contract is your right to litigate the claim of breach of contract in state court. Now, we've said that often. Your brief cites none of the cases in which we've held that. You just assume that a claim for breach of contract can be litigated in federal court under the Due Process Clause. Well, why are you assuming that, given that we've held the opposite?
Well, I believe this Court has held that a contract or breach of contract does establish the interest that is needed in order to establish due process rights.
But that would make every single contract case dealing with a state entity a due process case.
Yes,
in federal court.
It would, and that's why we held in cases like Mid-American Waste Systems against Gary, take a look at 49 Fed 3rd 286, that your proposition is wrong, that these cases have to be litigated in state court. Now, here we are 17 years later, and the whole premise of your submission is that Mid-American Waste had come out the other way. Well, no, it didn't.
Your Honors, we have claims here that are based, in fact, on the contract, as you are stating. We also have claims for equal protection. And the due process claim we are asserting here is the same, I believe, due process claim that has been asserted in a number of other cases in which the breach of contract shows that the standard that is to be applied by the state institution is one which meets due process standards. So with respect, Your Honors, we believe that this is distinguished from any case that
and
has been held.
You believe this based on a careful analysis of the holding in Mid-American Waste Systems against Gary?
Your Honor, I will not dispute your careful analysis versus mine, but there is a disagreement.
I don't think you're aware of this line of cases. Your brief cites none of them. If you're aware of them and think they are distinguishable, the thing to do is discuss them in your brief. But your brief cites none of them.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And I'm not sure how this case is different from our relatively recent decision in Hlavacek, which also indicated that there is no constitutionally protectable interest in continuing one's graduate education. I mean, clearly university, you know, if you ask the question, should the faculty of the Indiana School of Dentistry or this set of three judges decide who should be a dentist in Indiana, it's pretty hard to say we should.
Your Honor, there are some standards in which courts must make decisions. If a decision to dismiss a student was on the basis of her race, ethnicity, if the decision was based upon false statements that were knowingly placed in the record that showed her academic performance to be substantially different from what it was.
We don't review that. That's a decision for the faculty. If there's some federal statute like no race discrimination, we might review that. But no, there's no federal statute about not dismissing students on the basis of false statements by malicious people. Right? Where's the false statement by malicious people statute?
Then if that were to be the case...
Is there such a statute?
I'm aware of no specific statute on that point. I am aware, however, that if there is no judicial review, even if grades are falsified, changed on the record, and used as a false pretense to dismiss, or even if there's only one person, let's say there is one accuser, and that accuser is in a position to change the records presented to the new dean, there would be no review of that, because even fraud would be permitted if there's no judicial review.
What would the Indiana courts have done with your case?
Well, the Indiana courts presumably would not have looked at the Due Process Clause. The Indiana courts would have looked
at... Certainly they would have. The Due Process Clause applies in all 50 states.
I understand, Your Honor. They would have looked first at the Contract Clause, I would assume. And in Indiana law, as in fact stated in one of the cases cited by the defendant, the Gordon case, it is acknowledged that good faith and fair dealing is an implied portion of every contract. And this case is substantially distinguished from Gordon on many points, including the fact that in Gordon, I believe there was summary judgment that was appealed, and including the fact that here we have a specific contract that was alleged. So the contractual issues, which are attached to the complaints and attached here in the briefing, list specifically the rights that the individual had, the rights to academic, they are specifically stated, I'd be happy to read them to you, but
you have them
in the appendix.
No, don't do that. But I guess the reason I raised the point is that the Indiana courts would have been open to have considered whatever type of contract, express or implicit, might exist between a student and a university. And if there's been breach, the court could have decided whether either side had performed, whether the university performed or whether the student had performed.
The implied question, Your Honor, is whether or why a federal case was initiated instead of a state case. I was not counsel at that time. I don't know the reason why.
Okay, that's fine.
What I do know, however, is if this case stands as it is right now, that her rights, which I believe and which the record I think shows here, are very well founded, will be lost because of the haste in which there was a dismissal and entry of judgment without leave for appeal, not even considering at the district court or here the issues that now have been brought about.
Okay.
I think I'm out of the schedule
time. You're in your rebuttal
time
if you want to save it.
I will save my rebuttal time. Thank you.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Brundage.
May it please the court, this case is only about contract. There is no fundamental constitutional right to a graduate school education. Any property rights have to spring from state contract law. This court has established in Ross versus Creighton and Bissasora versus...
There is a potential for a federal claim if for some reason Indiana's judiciary didn't adjudicate contract claims. Because then you could say we have a property right, but the state is depriving us of any process to vindicate our property right. I didn't hear from Mr. Ackerson an argument that state courts would not adjudicate a contract claim against the university. Would they adjudicate such a claim?
Certainly they would. And I can tell you why Judge Lawrence was correct in dismissing this complaint, because it didn't state a claim for breach of contract under Indiana and this court's precedents. And this court's precedents that are relevant are the Ross case and the Business Store case from just 3 years ago.
Wait, I'm lost. I don't think we can adjudicate a claim for breach of contract here in anything like the normal way. Indiana University is part of the state of Indiana, right? And we, federal courts, can't adjudicate state law claims against units of state government. That's a pretty fundamental norm. So I certainly hope that we don't understand the district court as adjudicating, in violation of the 11th Amendment, the substantive contract claim. That's something that belongs in state court or nowhere.
I think one reason that Judge Lawrence had to decide whether it stated a claim for breach of contract is because there is no fundamental constitutional right. So to get to a due process claim, the plaintiff had to show that he had a right, a property interest based on state law. Therefore, he had to allege a contract, and Judge Lawrence had to decide that issue before he could deal with the due process claim.
No, you're obviously no more acquainted with Mid-American Waste and its successors than Mr. Ackerson is.
I'll admit I am not, Your Honor.
The law of this circuit is that suits like this should be dismissed without adjudication and sent to state court.
I think it's possible that Judge Lawrence could have dismissed everything except the contract count.
No. You're obviously not aware of it. The contract count is the thing that had to be dismissed without adjudication, unless there was an allegation that in Indiana the courts refused to enforce contracts like this.
And there isn't.
And there's no such allegation.
I think he could have dealt with, resolved, entered judgment on everything except the contract count and perhaps sent the plaintiff.
When you're winning, why are you fighting with
him? I'm sorry.
I say, when you're winning, why are you fighting with him?
I guess I'm just trying to get on the same page, Your Honor. I'm not sure I am.
You're obviously. Just let him have his own page.
All right. Well, all right then.
So the only thing that I would add is, the district court's opinion, which I'm just browsing through again, dismisses all these various constitutional theories. And there's one part at the beginning where the district court actually dismisses on the breach of contract claim. And whether that dismissal is essentially a jurisdictional 11th Amendment type dismissal that's inherently without prejudice, or whether it's something else, is the only thing we're really talking about. I mean, clearly getting rid of the federal claims is a different matter. So I'm just saying there apparently were a number of theories in this complaint, and the district court goes through all of them.
That's correct.
But suing, and anytime a state gets, I'm sure you must have this like as a macro in your computer. Anytime the state gets sued for anything, they come back and say you can't sue us in federal court because of, either we're not a person under 1983, which is actually the preferred ground if that's the theory of the case, or somehow if that isn't implicated, there may be an 11th Amendment dimension.
I have viewed this in the past that the state law contract claim has been dealt with as a pendant state law claim. And in the Bissasor case, Judge Barker at the district court went through the analysis that to state a claim for breach of due process, you either have to have a constitution.
That's the problem. The Supreme Court said in Pennhurst against Halderman that federal courts must not adjudicate contract claims against units of state government. They just must not do it. Right? So saying this is all a contract claim, it just means we're in the wrong set of courts. If it's a distinctive due process claim, it's either because the state courts are closed, of which there's no allegation, or because the process that would be provided by the state courts is insufficient. And there's no allegation like that either. The due process argument, plaintiff's due process argument, seems to be that Park didn't receive the process called for by the contracts.
That's correct.
And that argument is inconsistent with holdings of the Supreme Court in cases like Hewitt against Helms and Olam against Watkin and Kona, both of which are more than 30 years old and neither of which is cited by the parties in this case. And at that point, it's not clear what's left.
Well, Your Honor, I'll be frank. I was prepared to demonstrate to you how, under the analysis of Ross and Bissasor, there is no breach of contract claim adequately stated by the plaintiff's complaint.
Real question is whether one could be, and the answer is no, so go from there.
I'm sorry?
See, the question is whether one could be, and the answer is no, so what difference does it make?
I'm happy to take that position, Your Honor, and if there are no other questions.
You haven't up till now. I mean, you're busy fighting with
I think that's just a reflection of my not getting on the same wavelength here. But if there are no other questions, I'm happy to rest.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Ackerson?
Yes, nothing that I anticipated, but there is something further. What I had anticipated was the concern about Ms. Park not having any day in court whatsoever. If there was no jurisdiction at the state court, at the district court level, then she should be able to proceed, certainly on her contract claim. And if there was jurisdiction, at least for the equal protection claim, then she should be able to proceed in the district court on that. We were, in fact, relying on a dispute arising out of Bissasor, which I was prepared to discuss, and other cases that have, we believe, dealt with state universities in federal courts. But if that is inconsistent with this court's and 30 years of precedent, then of course we should not pursue that. What I will ask is, looking at the seven cases cited by the defendant appellees here with respect to not granting leave to amend, none of them is any way in any manner similar to what happened here. Two of them were after summary judgment. One was after judgment of the pleadings. Two were adding new counts near trial. Some were after a First Amendment complaint had already been granted. And the one that is closest, actually, was the Dohan case, in which after 19 months, a motion was presented for amendment for the first time a few weeks before trial. And that was described by Judge Bauer, as a matter of fact, with the court. That was described as a close case. Your Honor, we don't believe this is a close case. The interests of justice would require this be remanded. If it is remanded for the purpose of dismissal in deference to a state court, I'm sure my client will be happy to go to a state court. So if that is the disposition, we simply want to have the day in court. If it's in a state court, we have no objection to that. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.